From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
This is going to come back to haunt them if, and that's a big if the mainstream press still has the guts to say, hey, you know, we were taken in, and we don't like to be lied to. And on behalf of the American people, we're going to tell the real story here. And the story is that the ostensible justification for this war was bogus, contrived. It was a lie.
Former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, with the agency for more than a quarter of a century, participated in the daily briefings of President George Bush Sr. for several years. Today we'll spend the hour with Ray McGovern and one of his colleagues, David McMichael. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate yesterday voted 55-40 to overturn all of the controversial new media ownership rules approved by the Federal Communications Commission. A dozen Republicans led by Mississippi Senator Trent Lott joined with Democrats in passing a, quote, resolution of disapproval that gives Congress the power to block federal agency regulations. Senator Byron Dorgan, Democrat of North Dakota, warned the FCC rules would lead to, quote, galloping concentration in the media industry. The White House has threatened to veto any measure that diminishes the FCC rules, which were lobbied for by the major media organizations. The resolution now heads to the House, which is not expected to approve such a sweeping measure. The Senate vote came less than 2 weeks after the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit in Philadelphia put the new FCC rules on hold as it considered an appeal. We now go to the floor of the Senate yesterday to hear Senator Byron Dorgan, who sponsored the resolution.
Now, the FCC is a regulatory body. One would expect them to wear striped shirts and have a whistle and blow the whistle, when they need, on behalf of the public interest, to stand up for the public interest. But when regulatory agencies refuse to stand for the public interest, then we must take action. My colleague, Senator McCain, talks about S-1046. I'm a co-sponsor of that legislation. I support it very strongly. I hope the Senate will pass that as well. I will only observe that this resolution disapproval will run into some whitewater rapids when it gets to the House. I understand that. So too would S-1046 if that would ever get to the House of Representatives. But the fact is, we ought to, in every conceivable way, avoid the problems that will come from these rules. My colleague and others have talked about the problem of growing concentration in the media. It is getting worse, not better. The worst possible result, in my judgment, would be to say, let's just let the FCC rules go into effect. A circuit federal court, has already issued a stay. They understand that the American people weren't given the opportunity in the hearings, one hearing that existed in Richmond, Virginia. The case has not been made for this FCC rule. So we have a stay at the federal court. A reasonable step and a thoughtful step on behalf of this Senate is to stand up this morning for the public interest and say to the FCC, you had a responsibility and you failed. We have every right under the Congressional Review Act to enact this morning a resolution disapproval. And I hope sufficient numbers.
And that is Senator Byron Dorgan, who sponsored the resolution. Again, the Senate yesterday voted 55-40 to overturn all the controversial new media ownership rules approved by the FCC on June 2nd. In other headlines, the United States yesterday vetoed a UN Security Council resolution that called on Israel to drop its threat to harm or expel Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. The U.S. was the only Security Council member to oppose the resolution. Three countries abstained from the vote. Palestinian negotiations minister Saeb Erekat responded to the vote by saying, quote, the U.S. veto is a black day for the U.N. and for the Arabs. I hope Israel does not understand the decision to kill the resolution as a license to kill President Arafat. The London Sunday Times is reporting the U.S. and Britain have decided to delay indefinitely the public release of a full report on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. A progress report from the Iraq Survey Group, headed by weapons inspector David Kaye, was originally expected to be released this week. The Sunday Times reports no report will be issued because the hunt for chemical and biological weapons has so far ended in failure. Unnamed Defense Department officials are telling the New York Times that the main source of resistance against the U.S. in Iraq is not coming from foreigners or ex-members of the Ba'ath Party, but ordinary Iraqis who oppose the U.S. occupation. This analysis contradicts the public statements of Pentagon head Donald Rumsfeld, who yesterday described the U.S. enemies in Iraq as, quote, dead-enders, foreign terrorists, and criminal gangs. But the unnamed officials say classified U.S. intelligence shows opposition to the U.S. extends well beyond the Sunni heartland. One defense official said, quote, to a lot of Iraqis, we're no longer the guys who threw out Saddam, but the ones who are busting down doors and barging in on their wives and daughters. The U.S. military is now holding 10,000 prisoners in Iraq, including six people claiming to be U.S. citizens and two who say they're British. The number of prisoners is twice as high as previously reported. The Senate, by a 53-41 vote yesterday, rejected a measure that would have put a ban on bunker buster nuclear bombs. Senator Ted Kennedy, who called for the ban, warned the U.S. is starting a new nuclear arms race. Kennedy said, quote, at the very time when we're urging other nations to halt their own nuclear weapons programs, the administration is rushing forward to develop our own new nuclear weapons. Sources close to Wesley Clark say the retired four-star general will announce today he's entering the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. Political analysts said the news was leaked yesterday in order to drown out Senator John Edwards' official announcement that he's running. Clark has never held office before and is best known for commanding the NATO forces that bombed Kosovo. He has surrounded himself with advisors from the Clinton and Gore campaigns. Federal agents in Connecticut are now arresting all illegal immigrants as soon as they're issued orders of deportation, marking a major policy shift. Until now, most immigrants have been allowed to remain free while they appeal their deportation order. The Department of Homeland Security is testing a pilot program in Connecticut, which is scheduled to begin nationally on September 30th. The department estimates there are 400,000 cases where immigrants in the U.S. have ignored deportation orders. Wired.com is reporting that the Senate has slashed hundreds of millions of dollars from the budget of DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. The Pentagon's office had come under big criticism over the past year for proposing programs such as the Big Brother-like Total Information Awareness. DARPA's Information Awareness Office, which was until last month headed by John Poindexter, will face the largest budget cuts. This news from Sweden, 35-year-old man identified by the Swedish press as having ties to the far right, has been arrested and charged with the murder of the foreign minister, Anna Lenn, who was killed last week. And over 100,000 residents on the East Coast have been urged to flee their coastal homes and head inland. As Hurricane Isabel approaches, North Carolina and Virginia have declared a state of emergency in advance. Washington, D.C. has been placed on hurricane alert. Meanwhile, concern is growing that the large deployment of National Guard members overseas in Iraq has left the states with depleted forces to help during a local emergency. In South Carolina, the military estimates one-fifth of the state's National Guard is overseas. In addition, a military official said the Guard's best dump trucks, backhoes, and other heavy equipment are not in South Carolina, but in Iraq.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away. Wonder this time where she's gone. Wonder if she's gone to stay. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and this house just ain't no home.
You are listening to Democracy Now. I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday, we took a look at Vice President Dick Cheney's use of intelligence, or rather lack of intelligence, as he repeated many allegations about Iraq that have been proven false over the last 2 years. One of those allegations is that Saddam Hussein attempted to acquire uranium from the African country of Niger. Well, yesterday, we interviewed Ambassador Joe Wilson, the former acting U.S. ambassador to Iraq under George Bush Sr. The CIA sent Wilson to investigate the uranium allegation in 2002 and found it highly unlikely. Despite this, the uranium Niger claim became a key piece of the administration's justification for the war, and President Bush included it in his State of the Union address in January. Vice President Cheney repeated it again this past Sunday. 7 months later, Wilson went public in a New York Times op-ed. He said he had told the CIA long before the president's January speech that the uranium claims were suspect. A week later, conservative columnist Robert Novak wrote a column in which he cited two senior administration officials. They said that Wilson's wife was a CIA operative. Time Magazine and Newsday also cited administration officials and repeated this claim. Was this retaliation against Wilson for stepping forward? It is, in fact, a felony to blow the cover of a covert operative. Yesterday, on Democracy Now!, we played Ambassador Wilson's speech, an excerpt of it, that he gave at a forum in Seattle, Washington, on August 22nd.
Well, Mr. Wilson, assuming what Robert Novak said about your
this
wife
is a questioner
true and the seriousness of that, can we expect the FBI to give a complete, unhindered investigation into that? And find out wherever it leads to?
I'm not sure I know how to answer that. Because we're talking in hypotheticals, the way the process works is if this were to have been true, the CIA will do an internal investigation and determine whether or not, in their judgment, a law has been broken. They then refer to the Justice Department, who takes another look at it, and then it's referred to the FBI for further investigation. Now, despite the fact that John Ashcroft's in charge of the Justice Department, this violation, if it is in fact a violation, is one that is a violation of a professional. And the investigation and the look into this will be done essentially by professionals. Now, there is a lot of interest in Congress. Henry Waxman has been keenly interested in this and offered all sorts of support. Chuck Schumer, Mr. Gun Control, came out and made a statement to the effect that if true, this was like putting a gun to the head of an agent. John Dean, of all people, just wrote the other day that the president should have extended a Secret Service protection to me and my family as a consequence of this. He didn't, by the way. Although I will tell you, I think they're scared to death that I might stub my toe. I have confidence that at the professional level that whatever they think is doable will be done. My own sense is that, and I've told the FBI this, that should they decide to undertake an investigation, that I want to talk with them to see how I can best support the investigation, not do anything to impede it. And I think I do have a vote in this, since Congress has basically said we'll do anything we can to support you. And the question is whether or not having Chuck Schumer and Hillary and others go forward and talk about this openly, Dick Durbin, impedes or helps the investigation down the road. But we'll see. I mean, I don't think we're going to let this drop. At the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog marched out of the White House in handcuffs. And trust me, when I use that name, I measure my words.
And that was Ambassador Joseph Wilson. After we broadcast his comments yesterday on Democracy Now!, a reporter questioned White House spokesperson Scott McClellan about the outing of Joseph Wilson's wife.
On the Robert Novak, Joseph Wilson situation, Novak reported earlier this year, quoting anonymous government sources telling him that Wilson's wife was a CIA operative. Now, this is apparently a federal offense to burn the cover of a CIA operative. Wilson now believes that the person who did this was Karl Rove. He's quoted from a speech last month as saying, at the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog marched out of the White House in handcuffs. Did Karl Rove tell that?
I haven't heard that. That's just totally ridiculous, but we've already addressed this issue. If I could find out who anonymous people were, I just said it's totally ridiculous.
Once again, Scott McClellan, White House spokesperson, evasive, being questioned by Russell McIver of the Corporate Crime Reporter, never outright denies the charge. That's just not the way the White House operates, he has said. Now let's take a listen to Ambassador Wilson on Democracy Now! Yesterday when we interviewed him.
Well, first of all, if you go back and you take a look at the Novak article, it quotes two senior administration sources. That basically is code for the White House. And these sorts of things, the press office, Scott McClellan, was absolutely denying that he knew anything about it or had any knowledge of what may have happened. That doesn't leave too many offices within the White House that would be interested in this. The political office is obviously the next place to look. Now, my own sense is, as I said in those comments, is that I want to make sure that that the appropriate investigation is done and that it leads in the direction that leads wherever it may lead to find out who was responsible for this, if, in fact, the assertion in Novak's article was accurate.
Ambassador Joseph Wilson. Well, a number of senators, including New York Senator Charles Schumer, Dick Durbin of Illinois, Congressmember Henry Waxman, and others, have called for an investigation into who outed Joseph Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, as a CIA operative who blew her cover. We called the White House to see if they were conducting an investigation. They said to call the FBI. We called the FBI. They said they're looking into it, but that they would not yet classify it as an investigation. Well, today we turn to an interview that I did with two former CIA analysts to talk about just what it means for an analyst or agent to have their cover blown. While we had in the studio, we talked about many other issues as well to shed some light on the way intelligence or lack of it has been used over the years. We began with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who worked closely with George Bush Sr. when he was director of Central Intelligence right through his presidency. And the law was passed under Bush's watch that made the blowing of a covert operative a felony. We're going to turn now to that interview. Let's go back in time to something that former President Bush, this is George Bush Sr., said. Langley, Virginia, he's at the Central Intelligence Agency. I'm reading from an Associated Press report. Former President Bush, helping the CIA celebrate its 50th birthday, called agency critics nuts. He singled out for criticism Philip Agee, a former CIA agent and later critic of the agency. Remember Philip Agee, who I consider a traitor to our country? Bush asked, referring to Agee's efforts to expose CIA operations and identify spies. Bush said some of the criticism of the Directorate of Operations ruined secret U.S. clandestine operations in foreign countries, and in one instance blew the cover of CIA station chief in Greece, Richard Welch, who was assassinated outside his residence in Greece in the mid-1970s. Bush was careful not to directly link Agee to Welch's death. Agee dropped a defamation suit against former First Lady Barbara Bush earlier this year after Mrs. Bush acknowledged that the first edition of her memoir was erroneous in saying that Agee had exposed Welch's identity. David McMichael, explain this. And
yeah, well, after the Mrs. Bush's memoir came out with that statement, which charged Philip Agee effectively with commission of a felony, that is, violation of exposing
Richard Welch's identity.
Exposing
as a CIA
Richard
man.
Welch. Okay, that's a libel per se, as they say in law. And Philip Agee filed a lawsuit some months after the book came out in Washington D.C. Charging libel and seeking damages for that. The case, he did not drop the suit, let me put it that way, that's erroneous. The case was dismissed by the presiding judge on grounds that Phillips place of residence at the time did not give him standing to sue in U.S. court on this. And the case went away. The subsequent, I think as the article indicates and you said, subsequent editions of Mrs. Bush's book did not contain this erroneous charge. But it serves to indicate that this is a very serious matter. If former President Bush could define Philip Agee as a traitor for exposing the identities of serving intelligence officers, if his son's political advisor has done the same, while it does not come under the heading of treason, believe me, it is a very serious felony under the current act.
Ray McGovern, you worked for George Bush under in the CIA when he was director of Central Intelligence. It was right at the time of the Richard Welch assassination. Mm-hmm. Were you at this 50th anniversary party?
I was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they invited a whole bunch of alumni and alumnae back, and so I was witness to those events. I would like to add that I do not condone what Philip Agee did, nor does Dave. However,
Though he says he did not expose Richard Welch as a CIA.
Well, not Richard Welch, but he did expose many operations and many identities, and I think that is really unconscionable. But what I would say is that the law came in, if I'm not mistaken, Dave, in direct reaction to what Agee had done. This was the intelligence identities law, and it was made draconian. It was made very, very specific, automatic penalties that would accrue to both officials and non-officials. Anyone who knowingly disclosed the identity of a CIA agent or officer undercover, okay? And so with that kind of background, you get an idea for how critical it was judged to be, that agency operations, which depend on concealed identities, needed to be protected, and needed to be protected in such a way that those violating those confidences would be prosecuted and extremely penalized. What this indicates, I mean, this is all sort of in the weeds until you step back and you say, well, why is this all happening, you know? And it's all happening because there are lies upon lies, deceit upon deceit, that had been used to justify this illegal war against an unprovoked enemy, or an enemy that does not provoke us. And once the lies start unraveling and people see that they can speak out, that's going to be real trouble for the administration. And so what do? Well, you do all you can to intimidate them. And how you intimidate them is to try to hurt them in a personal way. And going after somebody's wife, I mean, not even Richard Nixon stooped to that.
We're talking to Ray McGovern and David McMichael, two former CIA analysts with the agency for more than a quarter of a century. We'll be back with them in a minute. Democracy Now!, Ray McGovern, our guest, a former CIA analyst. You were with the agency for
27 years.
And you worked directly under George Bush.
I did when he was director of CIA, and then later I saw him every other morning for a couple of years in the 80s when he was vice president.
Doing what?
I was one of the briefers who prepared the president's daily brief and delivered it and briefed people one-on-one with the senior officials downtown.
Now, one of the things we're talking about a lot and seeing a lot is that the same people who were there during the Reagan-Bush years and even before, the Wolfowitzes, the Rumsfelds, Cheneys, were there then. What was George Bush's view of these people then?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. When we saw these people coming back in town, all of us who were around in those days said, my God, the crazies are back. You know, the crazies. That's how we referred to these people.
Did George Bush refer to them in that way?
That's the way everyone referred to these
including
folks.
George Bush?
Well, when Wolfowitz prepared that defense posture statement in 91, where he elucidated the strategic vision that has now been implemented, Jim Baker, Secretary of State, Brent Scowcroft, the security advisor to George Bush, and Bush said, hey, that thing goes right into the circular file. Suppress that thing, get rid of it. Someone had the presence of mind to leak it, and so that was suppressed. Now, to see that arise out of the ashes and be implemented where we start a war against Iraq, I wonder what Bush the First is really thinking, because these were the same guys that all of us referred to as, quote, the crazies.
Including George Bush.
I don't want to, you know, there is a certain delicacy to all this, and the last thing I want to do is to do anything to impede the access of honest analysts who are willing to speak truth to power on these morning briefings. And so I'm not going to quote anything that the vice president said to me directly.
But on that issue, when you say when Wolfowitz, for example, brought forward the defense posture, explain what that was, what he was promoting.
Yeah. Well, he was promoting the idea that has now been implemented that we are the single superpower in the world and that we should act like it. We got a lot of weight to throw around. We should throw it around. And we should assert ourselves in critical areas like the Middle East. And over the next few years, the Project for a New American Century documents very much elucidate this kind of strategic vision and strategic plan. It's very much like Mein Kampf. I mean, it's the ideological strategic justification for what's been happening here. It's empire. It's how to increase our influence. And not coincidentally, it dovetails expressly with the strategic objectives of Israel in the Middle East. We mean to be the sole superpower, dominant superpower in the world, and Israel is determined to remain the superpower in the Middle East. And of course, if you talk about weapons of mass destruction, well, check out how many Israel has and ask yourself, when was the last national intelligence estimate on Israeli weapons of mass destruction?
Are these views that you hold, were they common, David McMichael, in the intelligence agency, in the CIA, for years among analysts?
Well, I can only speak to those, really to those 2 years that I served on the National Intelligence Council as a senior estimates officer. And
those years were?
Those were 1981 to 1983.
So under Reagan.
Under Reagan and under William Casey. As a matter of fact, I embarked on that job the day Casey came in. And, you know, I can assure you that the way in which the National Intelligence Council and the National Intelligence Officers, or the directing officers in there, were stacked during the Casey years meant that intelligence was designed, and I focused principally on Central America, the whole Iran-Contra thing later, you know. You know, truthful analysis was not the highest priority there. The determination was to produce analyses that would support the previously decided upon policy. So for me, getting back involved with Ray McGovern here and VIPS dealing with this current situation, it's sort of like deja vu all over again. It's a familiar process.
VIPS being Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you have put out a call now.
We have indeed, yeah. There have been a few courageous people who have stood on principle at some personal cost. Ironically, you know, we intelligence professionals, unfairly, we tend to dismiss Foreign Service officers as, you know, knee-jerk mouthpieces for the administration. Well, three such Foreign Service officers have stood on principle and have quit, some of them before the war ever started. And they have issued eloquent statements as to how their conscience would not permit them to have to tell these lies to folks and try to rally support for an unjust U.S. policy. Then there's Andrew Wilkie in Australia, an incredible person whom veteran intelligence professionals for sanity had to this country. We all chipped in and paid his fare. He spoke in Congress or at one of the congressional hearings. Andrew quit the Office of National Assessments in Australia, which is the CIA counterpart, 8 days before the war because he could no longer countenance his country going into a war on the basis of the intelligence that he saw to be bogus. And he spoke out immediately, and over the last few weeks, although you won't see it in the U.S. press, he and Prime Minister Howard in Australia have been having a personal argument in the press as to how the intelligence was over-egged, as the British say, exaggerated, sexed up, as some of the other British and the Australians say. So there is precedent for people speaking out, and I guess the most prominent American example of that is Daniel Ellsberg. And the interesting thing there is that, I asked Daniel Ellsberg, I said, Dan, do you have any regrets about outing the Pentagon Papers, which he gave to the New York Times and the Washington Post about Vietnam, which showed all the lies and deceit that went into that policy? He said, yes, Ray, I do have one major regret. I said, what's that? He said, I did it in 1971, and I should have done it in 1964 or 65, where it could have prevented this war or at least retarded it. And I said, Dan, why didn't you do it? And he said, Ray, it's hard to believe, but it never occurred to me. You know how it is when you get enmeshed in this culture and your loyalties get a little perverted and they become the loyalty to the little group, and it's beyond the pale to rise above that and to release information that you know the public should have. Well, that was my mind frame, so it never occurred to me. And so our latest appeal to intelligence professionals still working on the inside is, well, let it occur to you now. There are more important things. And we're not suggesting that they release classified information. All they have to do is tell what happened in the months before this war. Tell how bogus information was used, like forgeries, to deceive Congress. This is a constitutional crisis, to deceive the other branch of government.
Explain the forgeries.
Well, the forgery we referred to before with respect to alleged Iraqi attempts to seek uranium in Niger.
You know, we always refer to that, but mm-hmm. most people don't know what the fraud was that mm-hmm. was perpetrated.
Okay.
Explain what actually happened.
Okay. What happened was this. In early 2002, Vice President Cheney learned that there was a report floating around that the government of Iraq was seeking uranium for nuclear weapons in the African country of Niger. Now, he was so interested in that, for obvious reasons, that he and his staff went to the Central Intelligence Agency and said, tell me more about this. The CIA, in response, found out the best person to send down there, former Ambassador Joe Wilson, who knew Africa like the palm of his hand, who had served in Niger as well as ambassador to other countries.
Just to intrude here, on Wilson, what made him particularly important for that, he had been the deputy chief of mission in Baghdad just prior to the 1991 war, and actually had been when April Glaspie departed, serving as the effectively the U.S. ambassador then. So he knew Iraq and he knew Africa.
He was Bush's ambassador to Iraq at
exactly.
that time.
Exactly,
that is correct.
President
with
H.W.
high commendations from President Bush the First.
Yeah.
So Joe went down there, spent 8 days down there checking it out with the ambassador down there and everybody else who knew the situation. Came back and said, highly dubious, highly dubious. Number one, the government of Niger cannot, even if it wanted to, give uranium or sell uranium to Iraq. Why? Because it doesn't control it. Who controls it? An international consortium led by the French. Every ounce of that uranium is accounted for. There's no way it could do that. Number two, Iraq already has 50 tons of this yellow cake uranium, doesn't know what to do with.
And again, to intrude, all of which was under control of the IAEA,
yeah.
the International Atomic okay. Energy Agency.
The yellow cake that Saddam Hussein had.
The existing uranium ore that they had, yeah.
So on the strength of that, the ambassador's report was that, forget it, this is really bogus, this report. It just can't. The first thing you do as an intelligence analyst or any kind of analyst is look at the substance of the report. If it makes no sense, it hardly matters what kind of source was behind it. But in this case, it really did matter, because later it was discovered that this report came from deliberate forgeries, and crude forgeries at that. Okay, so what I'm reminded of is...
By whom?
Well, it's not clear. One asks themselves, cui bono, you know, who would profit from this kind of thing? A lot of people suggest it was the Israeli service.
Mossad.
Now,
what evidence was there for that?
Just speculation as who would profit
again,
from
again,
this.
Again, to intrude, if I can, because you're interested in the detail of this, is the apparent conduit was through Italian intelligence service. Mm-hmm. And Ray's referring to the forgeries here, the documents that were passed forward. And they may have been passed forward by agents of one or another intelligence agent who were, you know, are under pressure to provide information to their control officers. The crude forgeries were that they purported to be Niger government documents. They were signed by a foreign minister who had been out of office for many years. They referred to constitutional provisions which no longer existed in Niger, and several other things. And this is the reason I would tend to excuse Mossad, because they're too good to put forward such blatantly and easily detectable pieces of paper trash. But go on, Ray, you got this.
Well, the real conspiratorial thing, of course, would be that Mossad would do it in a sloppy way, precisely so that folks like David McMichael would rule him out as the author of that.
But at this point, you don't know the evidence for that.
Well, we don't know, and it doesn't matter. Uh-huh. It doesn't matter, because the information was false on its face. And what happened, why this is important, is the following. This time last year, the decision had already been made to go to war. Dick Cheney led off the charge on the 26th of August of last year, when he said that, among other things, Iraq was starting to reconstitute its nuclear program. Now, the next thing they needed to do was to persuade Congress that the situation was serious enough so that Congress would cede its war-making powers to the executive. What evidence did they have? Well, they looked around. Zippo. Well, we have the aluminum tubes. Well, the aluminum tubes had already been discounted by all nuclear scientists and engineers.
The story that was on the front page of the New York Times the Sunday of Labor Day last year, when they rolled out their new product, Judith Miller's piece.
Exactly right. Yeah, these were tubes that were alleged to be essential for a nuclear processing thing that would produce nuclear weapons material. So if they checked with the Department of energy specialists, they would have known right off the bat that these were not suitable for that purpose, and now everybody accepts that that was bogus. But it worked. I mean, for those months, it was used in Congress as evidence they were pursuing a nuclear program. But since there was a lot of controversy there, they looked for what else was around. And somebody said, well, how about those reports that Iraq was seeking uranium in Niger? We can use that for sure. And they said, well, you know, that CIA has poured cold water on that. Well, yeah, but who's gonna know about these doubts? Well, nobody, unless we tell them. Well, do we have to tell anyone about of this? Well, the UN wants to know about these reports because they've got word of them, and we've been putting them off. How long can we put them off? Oh, probably another couple of months. Well, what's the problem? We use this. We raise the prospect of a mushroom cloud. And, you know, Saddam Hussein, our first evidence that Saddam Hussein has got his hands on nuclear weapons might be a mushroom cloud used by the president on the 7th of October, used by Condoleezza Rice on the 8th of October, used by Victoria Clark, the Pentagon spokesman, on the 9th of October. On the 11th of October, Congress votes to give its war-making power to the president. Okay, this was effectively used, and you know, I'm sure they said, well, what if people find out that this was bogus information and indeed based on a forgery? And the answer had to have been, well, look, we'll get Congress to approve it. We'll have our war. We'll win it handily. The people in Baghdad will welcome us with open arms. And who's going to care at that point? Who's going to care if the case was built on a forgery?
But now, former CIA analyst Ray McGovern, as well as former CIA analyst David McMichael. We'll come back to their interview. They are two former CIA analysts who are calling on others to come forward, to speak up about what is happening today in the United States. You are listening to Democracy Now! Back with them in a minute.
Who wants a bomb? We don't want a bomb. Who wants a bomb? We don't want a bomb. Who wants a bomb? We don't want it. We don't want it. We don't want a bomb. Who wanted a bomb? Somebody must have wanted a bomb. Who wanted a bomb? Somebody must have wanted a bomb. Who wanted a bomb? Somebody must have wanted a bomb. Who wanted a bomb? Somebody must have wanted a bomb. They wanted a bomb. They needed a bomb. They wanted a bomb. They needed a bomb. They wanted a bomb. They needed a bomb. They thought they had 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 a bomb. Saddam said he had a bomb. Bush said he better bomb. Saddam said he had a bomb. Bush said he better bomb. Saddam said he had a bomb. Bush said he better bomb. Saddam said he had a bomb. Bush said he better bomb. What did he say better bomb for? What did he say better bomb for? What did he say better bomb for? What did he say better bomb for?
Whom bomb? Allen Ginsberg here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we return to the interview with two former CIA analysts, Ray McGovern, who worked under George Bush as director of Central Intelligence and then was part of his daily briefing as president of the United States. This is President Bush Sr., as well as David McMichael, former CIA analyst as well. But now you talk about October, and this was before the war. George Tenet has the suggestion taken out of George Bush's speech, a major address that he gave at that time. But then the famous 16-word statement in the State of the Union address, which brings us to one of the people who is leaving intelligence. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about him and the role that he played?
Alan Foley, you're referring to? Yeah. Alan announced just 3 days ago that he was leaving, and he was head of the analytic section that had purview over weapons of mass destruction. And it was he who suggested that those 16 offending words not be included in the President's State of the Union address. He was finally arm-twisted into condoning that. With the assurance that it would be blamed on the British.
Well, explain that. He says, and he testified before Congress.
Yes, he testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee that in discussions with a Mr. Joseph of the NSC, he suggested that since the agency didn't vouch for the business about the uranium, Iraq seeking uranium from Niger, that it ought not to be in the president's State of the Union address. Indeed, they had managed to get it out of previous presidential speeches. So why did they want to put it back in there? Well, finally, he was persuaded that, well, let's blame it on the British. Let's say, according to a British report, and Foley said, oh, God, I suppose that'll be all right to blame it on the British. Now, they didn't even say, according to a British report. What the president said was, the British have learned. That's a lot different, you know. We're pretty careful with words in the intelligence community, but that's what the British have learned that Iraq was seeking uranium from an African country, okay? Now, Foley took the fall for that together with Tenet, but, you know, it was really sort of Tenet saying, I confess she did it, because Tenet doesn't write these speeches. Condoleezza Rice is responsible for that. So what is Tenet confessing to? He's confessing to be a lousy proofreader. He didn't read the final draft, and there it was.
But Alan Foley said, we know this not to be true. And right. They said, well, why don't we just leave that part out and say that the British say it's true?
Yeah, we'll use it anyway, and we'll blame it on it. We'll say the British. We'll pin it on a British report. And, of course, to the normal, you know, I watched the speech. We all watched the speech. When the President of the United States says the British have learned something, the presumption is the President is telling the truth. And the President was not telling the truth, and everyone knew that.
So Alan Foley is leaving. How significant is that, David McMichael?
I think it's significant. The man, you know, cannot continue to be identified, whether he supports the policy or not, as an intelligence professional. He can't continue to be identified with a process that has been and is being corrupted And he's, you know, this is I don't like to use these terms, but ethical dilemma that that officers in these institutions frequently face. You may recall the official State Department report following Iran-Contra on El Salvador, and the language is indicative. It's that State Department officers were torn between their desire to tell the truth and their need to support the policy. So these things do come up, and it's very difficult for people who are pursuing careers in these bureaucracies, you know, to stand up and be counted at the cost of their careers, and that's just a fact of life.
Which brings us to Cheney's visits to the CIA. When people hear that, they might say, well, I mean, he's a vice president. He can go to the agencies that are under him.
Yeah. Well, you know, people have asked me in my 27 years, had this happened before, and whether this was unusual. And I tell them, this is not unusual. This is unprecedented. The vice president of the United States never, during those 27 years, came out to the CIA headquarters for a working visit. Not even George Bush the First came out under those circumstances. He did come out once to supervise or to be in attendance at an award ceremony, but never on a working visit. That's not how it works. How it works is we go down in the early morning and we brief these senior officials, five of them, vice president, secretaries of state and defense, the assistant to the president for national security affairs, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. That's how we did business. If there were questions and they needed more expertise, we'd bring down the specialists. We wouldn't invite them out to headquarters. This is like inviting money changers into the temple, okay? It's the inner sanctum. You don't have policymakers sitting at the table, as you are, Amy, helping us to come up with the correct conclusions. And that's the only explanation as to why Dick Cheney would be making multiple visits out there. Are you sure you thought about this? What about this uranium from... Send somebody down there to find all this stuff. It's very clear. And you're a mid-level official, and you're trying to be an analyst, and your boss is sitting behind you. There's a lot of pressure there. Now, let me just add one other thing, and that is Colin Powell brags to this day, very recently, he said, and I quote, "I spent 4 days and four nights at CIA headquarters before I made that speech on February the 5th, poring over the evidence, making sure that, well..." To anyone who knows how the system works, that's bizarre. The Secretary of State shouldn't be going out to CIA headquarters to analyze the evidence and make sure the evidence by that time, by God, should have been well analyzed, should have been presented in a document to which most people agreed and footnotes for those who don't agree, and presented to the Secretary of State in his office on the 7th floor of the State Department. And if he had questions, analysts would come down and see him. The prospect of the Secretary of State and Condoleezza Rice, who joined that group, coming out to the agency and saying, okay, what are we at now, 5 days before his major speech for the UN, is bizarre in the extreme. And, of course, we know how that speech came out. All the evidence that was adduced. You know, where is the 25,000 liters of anthrax? None of that information has been borne out in reality. And so we have a Secretary of State who picked the best, what he thought was the best evidence, and who said some really interesting things. If you look at that speech, let me just make one other thing about that speech. Among the things he said is that we have learned that Qusay, Saddam Hussein's son, has ordered the removal of weapons, prohibited weapons, from the presidential palaces, okay? Interesting. Okay, so we've learned that's pretty solid information. It sounds like solid information. Well, a couple of months later, we find Qusay, right? Now, if we're interested in finding out where those weapons of mass destruction are, it would seem to me that someone would have thought, hey, for God's sake, capture this guy. He knows where they are. He ordered their removal. Instead, what did they do? They fired 10 anti-tank missiles into Qusay and his brother, and a nephew of Qusay. Not my idea of how you get to the bottom of the story on weapons of mass destruction.
We're talking to Raymond McGovern and David McMichael. They're both former CIA analysts. Ray McGovern worked under George Bush when he was director of Central Intelligence, and then briefed him when he was vice president.
Right.
For how long?
For about 2.5 years. I did the briefings for 4 years, but my account in the first 2 years was the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
I want to get to two other issues. One is the David Kaye Report, and then 9/11 and the Intelligence Commission, for both of you. The David Kaye Report that is supposed to come out, that is supposed to, they stopped saying whether they found weapons of mass destruction every day. That was looking very bad. They said, we're going to give you a final report on this, David Kaye, the former UN weapons inspector. What's happening?
Well, it's hit the fan now. Let me just backtrack a little bit. On the 5th of December, Ari Fleischer, the president's spokesman, was quizzed about all these statements about weapons of mass destruction. And he ended up saying, look, the Secretary of Defense and the president are not going to make statements that there are weapons of mass destruction there unless they have solid evidence to support it, okay? Later in March, after the war had just begun, he said, Ari Fleischer said, well, weapons of mass destruction are what this war is all about, and we have high confidence that we'll find them. So there is no de-emphasizing the fact that that was the casus belli that the administration introduced. So to suggest now that we're not talking about weapons of mass destruction, but we're talking about paper of mass destruction. Now, let me explain. We don't say weapons of mass destruction anymore. We say weapons of mass destruction programs. Okay, now what does that mean? That means that in a very sinister way, as David is inclined to point out, Iraq still has nuclear scientists and nuclear engineers capable of reconstituting this program. That means that we will find, or that we will fabricate, documents showing that they have these plans to start making these weapons again as soon as the UN inspectors leave, okay? And that's all they have. And to think that that the, quote, solid evidence that Ari Fleischer cited, and the fact that weapons of mass destruction were what this thing was all about, not papers of mass destruction, this is going to come back to haunt them if, and that's a big if the mainstream press still has the guts to say, hey, you know, we were taken in, and we don't like to be lied to. And on behalf of the American people, we're going to tell the real story here. And the story is that the ostensible justification for this war was bogus, contrived. It was a lie.
I think one thing has to be added about David Kaye, who is identified as a former member of the UNSCOM, that is the United Nations weapons inspection teams, prior to the 1998 bombing and the departure of the weapons inspectors then, prior to their reinitiation under UN Resolution 1441. David Kaye, in fact, and this is not revealing the identity of an intelligence officer, David Kaye was, in fact, a CIA officer at that time. And one of the reasons that the initial inspection process broke down was because the United States and other member states of the inspection teams at that time began introducing their intelligence officers into this, and in fact, as has been documented, planting listening devices in the places where they were going for intelligence purposes, not for weapons inspection purposes. A second point to remember is that the primary task of the intelligence officer is to recruit agents. In other words, one could reasonably assume that using their cover as weapons inspectors, they were attempting to recruit Iraqi nationals to serve as intelligence agents and reporting. Naturally, the counterintelligence of any country attempts to block this, and it did serve to discredit the initial inspection process. So that's one thing that's important to remember about David Kaye's background. And as Ray has pointed out, the emphasis now is on the programs. And I joke a lot about these things. Unfortunately, I have a very bad sense of humor, and they will certainly find that Iraqi universities and even high schools have courses in physics and chemistry, and you can draw your obvious conclusions from that. So this has been pretty well flagged in advance that this is the way, you know, the Kay report will pass on. When Mr. Rumsfeld made his recent swing through Iraq and the Middle East, he essentially dismissed questions about what the Kay report would show. He said, "Well, we'll know when it comes out." There was no, so you know, it's very disturbing. But it gets back to the question which has been raised earlier in this discussion about how the United States press, the media, the United States public, and so forth, will react when it can be sufficiently demonstrated that the rationale for going to war with Iraq was at best shakily founded in the truth. Now, my reaction to this, again, going back to this, I've been working on these issues for the last 20 years and going through Iran-Contra and then on, is that the general feeling in the United States is that our ends are good, always. So who worries about the means? And I, if you will allow me, indulge me in one anecdote, which I think is illustrative. In 1985, during the first elections in Nicaragua following the revolution down there, the United States, and I know how it was done, you know, began to put forth reports that Nicaragua had acquired MiG fighters from the Soviet Union. You may recall this incident. Mm-hmm. And this was big buzz. United States fleet units were moved off the coast of Nicaragua, and, it was, you know, the fever was going. And I happened to attend the news conference that the Nicaraguan foreign minister, Miguel Descoto, was giving on this subject. And he was pointing out that this was entirely unfounded. There were none. It was being accepted. The correspondent for the Washington Post was there, Bob McCartney, as a matter of fact. And he got up and said, "Well, Mr. Foreign Minister," he says, I accept what you're saying, but suppose it were true that Nicaragua was getting this sort of weaponry, wouldn't it be logical for the United States to respond like this?" And Father Descoto looked at him a long time. He said, "Mr. McCartney," says, "we are not talking logical. We are talking pathological." And I always thought that
ideological, was maybe.
David McMichael, former CIA analyst. Raymond McGovern, former CIA analyst. Ray McGovern served as a CIA analyst for almost 30 years. From 1981 to 1985, he conducted daily briefings for George Bush as vice president under Ronald Reagan. That does it for today's program. If you would like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. You can also go to our website for a transcript of today's show or to listen or to watch today's program or any program on Democracy Now! I want to thank all the stations, the Pacifica stations and affiliates, the NPR affiliates, and the public access TV stations that run us around the country. More than 160 stations run us, as well as Free Speech TV on Dish Network Channel 9415. And if you'd like us to run in your community or have friends who do in other parts of the country, they can just call their public radio station or their public access TV station and ask them to run Democracy Now! We are broadcasting on TV and radio and on the internet at democracynow.org, where you can get all the information and look at the map of where we are broadcasting and the places you can go where we're not. You can join our daily digest by going to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Jeremy Scahill, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, and Pervez Sharma. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.